We're going to start with Pat Kuhl. Dr. Pat Kuhl is the Bezos Family Foundation Endowed Chair for Early Childhood Learning, the co-director of the University of Washington Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences, the director of the NSF-funded Science of Learning Center, and professor of speech and hearing sciences. She's internationally recognized for her research on early language and brain development and studies that show how young children learn language. Please join me in welcoming Pat Kuhl.
Thanks, Sally. It's wonderful to be here. I haven't been to an IMFAR meeting in a long time, and the energy level has tripled. And following Sally, there's tons of conversation about the topic that we're going to address this morning. So I'm a scientist who studies language learning, initial language learning, and I'm here to share some information with you today about how integrally we think of language systems and social systems, and how unusual that is, how heretical it would have been to say this, say 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, and it's hotly debated today. Is language an encapsulated module that operates only on its own rules and systems? Is it informationally separated from other aspects of cognitive and social systems or not? And I'm here to vote for the side of saying that it's not. That the work that we're doing on building the mind of the child, and trust me, the data suggests when you look at brain science from a very early standpoint, that child is building a brain. Areas are there that receive the right information. Visual, auditory, and language information goes to the right areas, but the coding of that information, the development of that brain system and its cognitivity depends on experience. So we've been doing studies. I'll show you a little bit of studies related to this MEG science that we're now doing with baby brains. You get functional movies of the brain as babies are listening to syllables or words. At the same time, we're looking at brain structure using MRI and DTI methods that not only allow us to look at each individual area and the growth of gray matter, but also and how it relates to environment, but the connectivity that allows these areas to talk to one another. Nothing important happens that we do unless the areas of the brain are in communication. We're also studying, we've been doing behavioral studies on initial language learning for 30-some years, and studying the intricate interaction and how important it is that for that child to be bathed in the social language experience. And we'll illustrate that with some data today. All of this and the context in which language is now viewed, embedded in a socio-cultural context, integrally related to the cognitive systems that are developing, all of that plays a role in understanding the frameworks that are being used to approach autism spectrum disorders. So we'll spend a little time here this morning on what are we learning about early development and typically developing children, and how has that been studied from the standpoint of language in children with autism. So you all know this graph, made popular by Newport in the late 90s, the critical period for second language learning. You find your age at the bottom, you find your score on the y-axis, and you can see that the children are geniuses, but each year from about the age of 7, there's a decline in your ability to learn a second language. Within that broad period, there are specific times in which there are critical sensitive periods for the sound learning, for word learning, for grammar learning. We're going to concentrate in the earliest ages of the critical periods for language on that phonetic learning, that first sound learning and early word learning. So here's a graph that describes work that's done in one study, but it reflects what's happening in children all over the planet. So we've done studies in my lab in 8 different countries demonstrating that in the early period, until 6 months of age, children are literally citizens of the world. They can discriminate every phonetic contrast used in every language of the world. And that distinguishes them from us because we discriminate the sounds from languages or the one language that we were exposed to in the first 7 years. So here's a study looking at American infants and Japanese infants. They're listening to a ra-la contrast, ra-ra-ra-ra, la-la-la. They have to turn their heads in a behavioral paradigm, or in an ERP paradigm, we look for a different response when this sound changes. So over this 2-month period, between 8 and 10 months, something pretty miraculous takes place. From this universal citizen of the world starting point, children all over the world are moving towards a specialization in their in the languages that they're listening to. Sound perception discrimination gets better, and for children for whom that's not a phonetically important contrast, the decrease is seen, this decline. This happens at the same time in children all over the world, and each of them moves towards the kind of learning they need to do to acquire words at 12 months. So Japanese kids are doing exactly what they should do in ignoring the RL contrast as they get towards 12 months. So we've been studying what's the magic that they're putting to work in that two-month period. How come I can't do it when I go visit, you know, France at 50? How come I'm not acquiring, you know, French in that two-month period? There's two period, there are two things, very different things that are going on that the children can do and we're not so good at. And we should think about how children with autism, given what Sally said, and the kind of isolation that their symptoms from social settings promote. The computational piece, I'm going to illustrate it by letting you listen to motheries, which is a signal that typically developing children love to hear, no matter what you oppose it with. Adult-directed speech or a non-speech analog that mirrors the frequency principles in a motheries or parentese signal. You'll hear an American woman and a Japanese woman, and I'll tell you the kinds of computations that infants take as they listen. So here are those two women.
Ah, I love your big blue eyes. So pretty and nice.
Wow, 大きな茶色いお目目.
Okay, this is mother's milk to the baby brain. And so what the studies have shown, not only in my own lab, but many labs across the country, is that babies are sort of statistical geniuses. They're calculating statistics, distributional properties of the sounds they hear before they can understand words. They're keeping track, and their minds are sensitive to distributional statistics. As you can see here in a cartoon form, distributional statistics for Japanese and this RL contrast and English are very different. It's a sort of a bimodal distribution of RL in English and a unimodal distribution of the Japanese R for Japanese. In the laboratory for typically developing children, you can change infants into more Japanese-type listeners where they can't hear the RL distinction or more American listeners where they're very good at the RL distinction in about 3 minutes of exposure to distributional statistics that vary between the two. So their brains are very sensitive in a way that will help them acquire phonetic structure in the language or languages they're listening to. Same thing is true for words, different kinds of statistics, and I can't talk about that at the moment. But just the point is they're very, very sensitive to statistics. When they listen to this mothery signal, the statistics get exaggerated. So here's motheries, adult directed at the top, infant directed at the bottom. She's talking to a lab assistant at the top. I had a little bit, and the doctor gave me Vindectin. Sounds like I do. It's typical, but not, you know, exaggerated. If she turns to her two-monther, she says, hey, you, can you say ah? Hey, you, say hi. I can't do it. It's too early in the morning. But she gets to 700 hertz. So these are very wild excursions that you see in parents, parentees, mothers, fathers, older children, when talking to infants in languages across the world. The important piece maybe is not so much this exaggerated intonation, but what happens when you slow speech down. You articulate more clearly. These triangles across three different languages show the connection. The big triangle is how we talk to infants, the red one. The blue one is how we shrink it down when we talk to each other. We talk rapidly and not clearly when we speak to each other because we don't need to. When we talk to the babies, we exaggerate it. It helps discrimination. If you record babies' first-person perspective using Lena recorders at home at 11 months and 14 months, and you look at vocabulary at the age of two, and we've just followed these kids to 36 months, the prevalence of parentese in the home by anyone speaking to the baby incredibly predicts, but very, very nicely predicts, words produced at 24 months. So it's an association, but we've seen it in study after study, where a standard speech is pretty flat. It doesn't predict future language. Parentese, especially one-on-one. So this was work done by postdoctoral students, Niran Ramirez Esparza and Adrian Garcia Sierra. They're now assistant professors in psychology at the University of Connecticut. Niran is a social psychologist. She measured 73 variables in the interactions. But the two that stand out are the prevalence of parentese and the prevalence of one-on-one interactions. One-on-one interactions are very reciprocal, and all of the things that Sally said pertain. So this social context that typically developing children love, we can buttress it with one other study to illustrate the role of the social brain. We demonstrated in an experiment in which we're exposing nine-monthers at the critical period to a foreign language. They've never before heard Mandarin or Spanish. These are different experiments. The video is not working, but the very social experience is a tutor, foreign-speaking, Mandarin speaker in this case, sitting on the floor with two mothers and babies, 12 sessions over a four-week period. And with that 5 hours of experience with Mandarin, what we demonstrated was that the babies were equivalent to the babies in Taiwan after those 5 hours at discriminating Mandarin contrast. Same thing was true for Spanish. They absorb the information. You give the brain the right information at the right time, and that kind of information is taken up. But when the same exact dosage and room and characteristics and everything was run with a television set, standard but beautiful DVD, the babies are very interested in it. They crawl up to it, they touch the screen, but they learn nothing. 12 sessions and the brain and behavioral measures following show they were equivalent to a control group that had never been exposed to Mandarin or to Spanish. Word forms are learned in the same way. So in the Spanish experiment, we exposed them to 10 Spanish words in the sessions and 10 control words. Afterwards, the ERP signatures to the Spanish words demonstrate that the signatures of learning those word forms are there. So what we're saying, we argued in, this was published in 2003. 2007, we took a pretty novel position, saying that for typically developing children, we think the social brain gates language learning very thoroughly, very fundamentally. It's grown out of that social setting. And that really is a very different perspective than the informationally encapsulated module of a Foderian sort of modular system. So it reflects a real change in how we think about what's happening as humans acquire language. So, of course, everyone in this audience knows this has deep implications for autism. So I'll show you the two experiments that we've published so far on children with autism. And we're using now event-related potential measures. In the typically developing kids, we've used both. In children with autism, we're using event-related potentials. In the same oddball paradigms, you're listening to ba, 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 ba. The deviant stimulus is another phonetic contrast like pa. We're looking for a change, and the deviant typically shows a negativity. When you compare toddlers on a ba, wa contrast, and you've got toddlers TD on the left, ASD on the right, what you see is a typical negativity. Negativity is plotted up now. It is sometimes in the right hemisphere more predominant for timing contrast, and we see that here. But the children with ASD, toddlers with ASD, showed no, in the group data, no MMN, no mismatch negativity whatsoever. Now, what was interesting is a behavioral measure that we took at the same time, which was a preference for motherese. They had two choices, snippets of motherese and snippets of a sine wave analog. So if you heard something like, hello, how are you, in motherese, the non-speech analog, which followed all the formants and the pitch contour, would go, hello. So it's like a warble that follows all of the frequency components in timing and amplitude. So the typical child with autism preferred the non-speech analog. None of the ASD children preferred the non-speech analog. None of the typical children prefer the non-speech analog. And when you sorted the children on the basis of a 50% or greater preference for the non-speech analog or motherese, what we saw is patterns that mirrored these, meaning those children who preferred motherese showed ERP patterns more typical, more like those on the left. Those who did not prefer, who preferred the non-speech analog, showed the pattern on the right with no observable statistically significant MMN. Here's a correlation that you could run with. They're supposed to be color-coded, but they didn't come across. Just look at the pattern we're plotting on the y-axis, the T3 amplitude peak, this to the Bawa contrast at the right timing. And on the x-axis, the percentage of turns to the non-speech analog. So the more a child preferred the non-speech analog, the more positive, meaning the less good that negativity was. So the less potent that baby's, that child, toddler's response was to the contrast. So we demonstrated this linkage between the social responses of children with ASD and their brain measures in response to the fundamental building blocks of language. Now we move on to words and a study. This is a study that's interesting given all of the data that Sally showed us in the last talk from the ESDM study, Early Start Denver model. These are the kids who are coming out. We were a part of that major project, taking the brain measures at various points in development. So we were comparing the typically developing children who are showing word signatures for known as opposed to unknown words. And what you see on the left in the TD group is at T3, Debbie Mills has demonstrated that over time, children will develop this left hemisphere specialization that you see for known words right in that 200 to 500 millisecond period. And this is the negativity shown in the blue curve as opposed to the red curve. Whereas the toddlers with ASD in this sample, again, showed no variation at that point in development. But as we all know with children with ASD, there's huge variability. And again, if you take the approach to split the group of ASD children to those with the highest social scores as opposed to the lowest social scores, you get a different picture. So here are the half of the distribution of ASD children with the highest social scores. And you see that specialization developing, demonstrating itself on the left hemisphere side. It's at P3, not T3, but in typically developing kids, you can see it in either one of these T3 and P3 electrode sites. Whereas the children with low social scores, you did not see it. You saw right hemisphere effects that are broader, timing slightly different, but nothing showing this left hemisphere specialization. Now, the interesting thing is we then took this P3 value, take the P3 value in all of the children, and use that to predict future performance. As Sally had mentioned, the kids were coming back at the age of 4, and they were coming back at the age of 6. Now, what I'm going to show you is the brain responses predicting from the 2-year-old measure to 6. We saw the same thing at age 4. It even got better at age 6. But here's the 2-year-old word marker, neural marker, for known words at age 2, predicting cognitive ability, adaptive behavior, and receptive language at age 6. And you can see how strong these correlations are, where you're looking at the time 1, that's age 2, amplitude at P3, and standardized scores that were taken in the sample for, excuse me, for cognitive, adaptive behavior, and receptive language. So this is really interesting that marker at age 2 predicted not just language scores, but scores across the board that have to do with social learning. So the premise we're now operating under is that social learning is the context in which language is learned. If you measure the brain and its responses to language, you're actually tapping something much broader. You're tapping language learning, but you're tapping that child's ability to learn socially. And that's a very good predictor, not just of language outcomes, but outcomes across the board. The other thing to mention with regard to these data, as Sally said, there are two different treatments going on in this group of kids. So you've got the ESDM and you've got the community treatment. So what we're demonstrating here, and early Denver is doing a lot better job, so there's significant differences in outcomes. But the ERP 2-year-old word measure predicts regardless. It predicts outcomes. All of these kids improved. They were all getting treatment. We have not got a group who didn't receive treatment. But in children treated by either of these two methods, the ERP measure at 2 predicts quite well their outcomes at age 4 and age 6. And I think that's really interesting. Okay, so the last experiments that I want to tell you about have not yet been done on children with autism, but we're working on it. We're using this monstrous machine, magnetoencephalography, $2.5 million device that's perfectly safe and perfectly non-invasive. It looks like a hairdryer from Mars, but you can sit under this totally silent machine, and we're tracking head movements in babies. We're the first in the world to put young infants in an MEG machine because they can sit comfortably. We've devised software that allows us to put 4 pellets on the head and that allows the baby to move. You can hand them toys. They can play. There are many different paradigms that can be used as a baby's in an MEG machine. And so this tracking that we can now do, it's like GPS for the head, it allows us to know where's Broca's area, where are the areas of this child's brain at all moments during the experiment. So I want to show you a study that we published the outcome for in 2014, just finished it and published it at PNAS. We're looking at babies as they're listening. She's listening through insert earphones, so that's why you can't hear anything. The sound is actually on in this movie, so just so you can see how quiet it is. That's the beauty of the device. So we're having the baby listening to a test sound, a syllable in English, following a standard sound in English. Again, the oddball paradigm, but there's two oddballs, so there's a double oddball. They're hearing a standard sound common to Spanish and English. Then they're hearing an English test and a Spanish test. And this is a 12-monther monolingual, so we are expecting to see some kind of specialization for English as opposed to Spanish. But the main thing that makes it exciting to start thinking about testing children with autism in this paradigm is that we can actually see activity not only in auditory regions where we fully expected it, of course, but in areas in which the child is producing a motor plan to talk back. So when we look at Broca's area, responsible for many things, critical to language, critical to reading, but critical to motor planning to produce speech, and look at the cerebellum also involved in forward prediction and in motor modeling, what we see is very interesting changes at the age of 12 months. So let's look at the movie. So here's one subject. We have that baby's, that 12-monther's MRI, segmented 150 areas, color-coded. We're focusing on two areas in superior temporal auditory regions. We're focusing on two of the three areas involved in Broca's area. And we're also doing DTI to measure the arcuate connecting them. Again, a very important signal. You're now going to see MEG data, volumetric data. The red bubbles are the strength of the MEG data. You can see the auditory signals very strong. But also look at the activity in Broca's. Within milliseconds of the onset, you see Broca's active. So that was the standard. Here comes the English test, stronger response in the auditory area, about the same in motor, but motor responses are there. Here comes Spanish. Okay. All right, so again, you see auditory, but it's not significantly different. This is what we expect from the standard. It looks the same. This baby is not responding to auditory changes when it's Spanish. However, Broca's area is more active. Broca's area is doing something more to the Spanish than to the English. So if you look at the red lines and you look at the blue lines over these three examples, what you see is auditory is doing exactly what we predicted. Broca's surprising us like crazy. And we're interpreting these data to say that by 12 months, that American learning, English learning baby is expecting English and knows something about the motor plans that they should begin to activate if they want to talk back to this signal. But when Spanish comes along, and this baby's never heard Spanish, that brain doesn't know what to do. What in the world would I do to pronounce that sound? And so you get extra activity in Broca's and extra activity in the cerebellum as it tries to work out a forward prediction that would account for the motor movements necessary for that signal. Now, this raises all kinds of interesting questions with regard to autism. Whether or not children with autism would show these responses. Is there that reciprocity? Is there that, this may be a kind of nascent social response that children that's at this age, typically developing, are very eager to imitate. They're very eager to produce any kind of sound in response to your speech, particularly face-to-face, though in these experiments, the baby's just listening over insert earphones. We don't have a face. I think it would be an exaggerated effect if the face were in front of the child. We're very excited to do these kinds of experiments with children with autism to see whether or not the kind of motor plans needed for speech or human action in general, would human action in general produce this kind of response? It's possible that it would. We know from prior experiments that this does not occur for non-speech. Non-speech analogs of speech do not produce this kind of activity in Broca's synchronized to the auditory signal. So that's the message that is coming from the laboratories of typically developing children and learning in the context of language and the social support. There's also a whole line of work on cognitive support with regard to executive function. I think what we're seeing is a language system embedded in the brain of the child. Nothing suggests that it's isolated. It's very, very strongly attached to the social underpinnings of language, to the cognitive support that we provide for language when we talk to children. Talking to children produces much more than just a sensory system reaction. It produces a brain that's ready to respond, and that will make very interesting tests to do in autism. I want to thank all the supporters for the work that we do on typically developing children. As you all know, it's expensive work to do, and we're very grateful to all of our sponsors. So thank you.
You can take a question as Paul comes up.
Okay. If there are questions while he's setting up? There are. It's time.
One question.
Paul, are you going to use mine?
Wonderful talk. Thank you so much. I'm an autism statistician at Department of Psychiatry, Harvard Med School, and I know nothing about this. I was fascinated by two things, two brief questions. With your sine wave warbled, you said there was no preference in the ASD group. I assume it's a sine wave convolution with that to get
it's,
that?
So in speech research, there's a lot of signals that are taking pure tones to follow the format frequencies and fundamental frequencies.
You do so a Fourier transform to
exactly,
get this.
Exactly, to extract the, and so they're pure tones, so you've got four pure tones essentially causing this warble that follows the amplitude envelope over time.
So have there been any studies where you sort of taper that off and move across a spectrum there on the amplitude, for example, to kind of see?
Yeah.
Because that would be kind of cool training.
It would be. Yeah, it's interesting. I think it raises, for us, it raises all these questions about when you show children with autism films of motheries, they hate the signal. They hate the raised eyebrows, the expressive eyes, the auditory excursions. They like much better a flat signal, a monotone signal, a non-exaggerated face. So one suggestion, of course, is that during the critical period when you need to get language in the brain, brain's ready for language. You need to feed those circuits, right?
Yeah.
So if you fed the circuits with a signal that was pleasurable to a child with autism, that was modulated in a way that they liked, that to me sounds like a promising kind of intervention.